Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So for our community, we've been in the traditional, observing the traditional rains retreat, and some of the people are at any given time, there's about four people of the community, four or five, that are actually in seclusion, and we're taking turns in two-week periods, two-week chunks. And for the people who are in retreat, in seclusion, it's a very helpful time to focus a bit more specifically on the formal meditation, formal practice. But even for the rest of us who are kind of maintaining the routine of the monastery, it's an encouragement to pay attention to and focus a bit more directly on our meditation practice. You know, the meditation practice is, I wouldn't say that it's the kind of the most important part of our life, but it is really important how to learn the skills of settling the mind, stilling the heart. And when we do it, we oftentimes tend to overthink, overcontrol, overreact to the content of our mind. We tend to make it more complicated than is necessary or is useful. I mean, it's interesting to recollect what the Buddha encourages for our meditation practice. It's certainly the emphasis on mindfulness of breathing and learning how to direct attention to the in and out breath. And it's easy to sort of think, well, yeah, well, what's the big deal? But so much of what we tend to do in meditation is get caught up in our thoughts, get caught up in our reactions, emotional reactions, reactions based on various biases that we carry around, whether it's conscious or subconscious or unconscious, and we get entangled in it. And to be able to have an anchor that is just simple. Breathing in, say, breathing in a long breath, one knows one breathes in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, one knows one breathes out a long breath. Breathing in a short breath, one knows one breathes in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath, one knows, one breathes out a short breath. That's pretty basic. And that's the fundamental instruction that the Buddha gives. Being able to attend to the breath. One of the things that is really wonderful about the breath is that it's completely impersonal. I mean, try to build a personality out of your in-breath. I mean, it's ludicrous. But our habit, whenever we experience some kind of suffering, some kind of distress, where we tend to go to is personality. That's how we try to figure it out. We try to understand it. We try to manipulate it, we try to get out of it, we try to annihilate it, but it's all on the level of personality and identity. And if we're come back to, was coming back to the breath as an experience, and stepping away from the personal, stepping away from the personality, stepping back from the identity habit, then we've got the opportunity to experience a rhythm of nature, an experience of a natural phenomenon, and to keep grounding our experience in that, to keep finding an anchor in that, and building our capacity of the heart to be aware, to be attentive, with that as the foundation. We start to build a momentum of awareness. I really like the phrase that Ajahn Sumedho uses of intuitive awareness. This intuitive awareness, this simple quality of the ability of the mind, of the heart, to know its experience. And as we keep returning to that, we have the opportunity to know and to see the different elements of, you know, what we would habitually take as personal or to identify with. We can relate to it in a different way. We can experience it. It's not that we're pushing it away or not recognizing it. We can experience it, but it's with the anchor of the breath coming in, the breath going out, the rhythm of this nature, a natural truth. And as the knowing becomes more consistent, the aspects that we would tend to take personal or identify with, those can come in and go out in the same way that the breath does. And we're able to release, relinquish, and then also have a much more, well, a kinder and more empathetic relationship with those different elements of experience, the different moods of the mind, the different thoughts that come up. Oftentimes, there's no real logic or rhyme and reason for a lot of the thoughts and moods and impressions, associations that the mind... It's just what minds do. You know, we tend to look for the patterns and assume either in some kind of exalted way of pointing to our obvious superiority as some sort of being, or we take it as evidence of our obvious pathetic hopelessness. But all it is thoughts and feelings. It's what minds do. It's what minds have always done. The actual reality, it's not about us at all. Which is, you know, that's actually a real relief. Now one can have this intuitive awareness of the experience of it, but one can also be present at its cessation. But using the breath as the anchor, using the breath as the foundation. Of course, you can. It's helpful to, I think, to really work with that sensation of the breath, the experience of it in the body, seeding the mind, seeding the heart with, you know, some kind of association, because say like the in breath and the out breath have, they feel different. The in breath tends to be there's a certain energetic quality to it. There's an energizing quality to it. The out breath tends to have a have a relaxing quality to it. It was just kind of natural. There's a natural experience to that. But making that conscious, as one breathes in, just really bringing attention to that energizing quality of the breath coming into the body, energizing the mind, energizing all the cells in the body, just energizing the different parts of the body. Breathing in, that energizing. Breathing out, just a relaxing, a settling. Or, you know, just making, like breathing in, brightening. Just bringing that to the mind, brightening. Just using it. Breathing in, brightening. Breathing out, softening. So that one's seeding the mind, maybe enhancing the natural qualities that tend to be there, but we often overlook or don't pay close attention to. Or we forget that we're breathing and just keep going to our thoughts and all of the projections and worries of the past, the future, whatever. So bringing that attention into the present moment, allowing that quality of an intuitive awareness to establish itself, allowing that to stand up within the heart, the sense of this quality of knowing. So that using the breath to cultivate a sense of stability, steadiness, allowing that to be a basis for, say, in the samadhi. Normally it's translated as concentration, but I think it's important to recognize that oftentimes with language, I mean, we have associations with. So the concentration tends to, I think for most of us in the English language, that has a tight, tense, constricting feeling to it. And, you know, the experience of, say, samadhi, it shouldn't be like that. It isn't its purpose. When samadhi is translated into Thai, it's just literally the firm establishing of the mind, which is really actually quite beautiful as a translation and as a direction to encourage the mind. Allow it to be firmly established. And, of course, the firmly established in this quality of knowing, of awareness, an intuitive awareness. Of the Buddha himself, when he talks about samadhi, it's not like a one-shot deal or a single experience, because the Buddha points to the different uses of samadhi or the different purposes of samadhi. Maybe purposes is probably a better word. Purposes, that firm establishing of the mind, we can direct it to different purposes, and it should be directed to different purposes, because it's a tool. It's a training of the heart, of the mind, and needs to be applied in certain ways. So it has a purpose, it has a function. Now, the first purpose that the Buddha talks about is the purpose of experiencing happiness in this very life. Wow, that's revolutionary. To actually feel good rather than, you see people meditating sometimes, you say, wow, they look so miserable. But the Buddha's points as a purpose is samadhi is there for experiencing happiness in this very life. And that's where he points to the jhanas, these states of stability of mind, stability and clarity of heart, of mind. Traditionally, the four jhanas, But those are, are states of happiness and well-being, and a refinement of happiness and well-being. The doorway in is, when the Buddha describes the cultivation of the jhanas, the first phrase that he uses in talking about the first jhana, secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unwholesome states. Where we direct our attention, what we lay as a foundation. So it isn't that there isn't such a thing as sensual desires or unwholesome states, but we're seeking a seclusion from that, stepping back from the habit of sensual gratification, sensual fantasy. Unwholesome states is it sort of covers the aspects of ill will, aversion, anger, sloth and torpor, sleepiness, drowsiness, restlessness, anxiety, doubt, wavering. Those are what the Buddha points to as, say, the unwholesome states that obstruct the mind and obstruct the fundamental goodness of the heart. So just learning how to step back from. And of course, how does one step back from that? Oh, breathing in. Breathing in a long breath, one knows one breathes in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, one knows one breathes out. Coming back to the breath. That's your that foundation, that basis. Allowing the breath to be a vehicle or a bridge to relinquishing. And as the mind gets more settled, how Ajahn Chah talked about it was that we keep relinquishing coarser aspects of our mental and emotional experience and incline to more refined aspects, so that, say, that pull to sensual gratification or getting worked up with righteous indignation over something, you feel, it's actually more settling to be with the breath. It's more settling to be with the heart that's actually more still, not so stirred up. It's a natural inclination because it feels better. It's not because you've got to force your mind into some kind of state of concentration. It's just that it feels better when we're not stirring the mind up with those kinds of habits. So that purpose, that function of providing happiness in this very life, it's a function of samadhi, or of the settling of the mind, of allowing the mind to become more stable and still internally. Another aspect that the Buddha points to as a function of samadhi is for knowledge and vision. And that can be, and is traditionally, talked about as the, say, knowledge and vision of, say, psychic phenomena, the divine eye, divine ear, experience of other realms. It's sort of, but that's sort of on the far end of the spectrum. If we could just have just knowledge and vision of our experience in a clear way. And it's interesting to see what's the condition that the Buddha points to, or as the catalyst for that experience of knowledge and vision. And the Buddha points to the perception of light when he talks about that as the that function or that purpose of samadhi. The tool that is used is the perception of light. And that's a really useful quality to brighten the mind, to consciously bringing up things that are the perception of light, something bright, something kind of radiant, something expansive, as an object of attention, because it changes the heart. And as we sustain attention on a brightening object, yeah, things become more clear. We start to see things in a more clear way. So that even if it doesn't sort of take us, because personally I don't have any experience of, you know, past lives, future lives, other realms of existence, but I know what it feels like when I step out of dullness and the mind starts to brighten. I mean, it feels very different, and there's a lot more opportunity for clarity. Clarity of vision and experience. The third, say, function or purpose of samadhi that the Buddha points to is for mindfulness and clear comprehension, so that we cultivate samadhi, develop our meditation practice so that we have enhanced that quality of mindfulness and clear comprehension. And when the Buddha describes his description of mindfulness and clear comprehension, what are we mindful of and what are we clearly comprehending? He points to the quality of internally within the mind, we experience feelings as they arise, feelings as they present themselves, as they stay, feelings as they cease. We experience perceptions as they arise, as they stay there, as they cease. We experience thoughts. So having mindfulness and clear comprehension, thoughts as they arise, thoughts as they persist, thoughts as they cease. So that mindfulness and clear comprehension is attending to feeling, perception, thought, as they arise, as they persist, as they cease. And, you know, that's really interesting because, again, it's sort of an object of our awareness and that mindfulness, the task. Because, so often when we want to experience samadhi, or we want to experience sort of more refined states of concentration, but, you know, the Buddha is saying, well, we need to do that, but that's also, it should be applied. And applying it towards that mindfulness, clear comprehension, so that we understand more clearly how those feelings, perceptions, and thoughts condition us, drag us around. We get pushed and pulled around by, how does it work? You know, it's very ordinary, but it's also the stuff of, you know, that takes us to, yeah, suffering and kind of experiences of real misery. It's also what takes us to feelings of, you know, exalted states. But it has to be clearly comprehended. We have to be able to be mindful of it and clearly comprehending. And so that stability of mind is essential. Otherwise, we get caught in the reactions. The last function, purpose that the Buddha talks about of samadhi is for the ending of the taints and the ending of the asavas. Asavas are the underlying tendencies within the mind that keep pulling us to suffering, keep pulling us to dukkha. And those taints or these underlying tendencies, underlying defilements. And this is, it's interesting because there's some people translate it as an inflow, some people translate it as an outflow, And there's a logic for both of those, in the sense that it's those underlying tendencies that tend to flow out, but it's also what we bring in. We take our experience and it floats in. So the asava of sensuality, the asava of being, becoming, the asava of non-being, not becoming, pushing away experience. And that our bhava-asava of being, becoming, and of course that goes in different ways, of either the being and becoming, wanting to be something, wanting to get something, or pushing it away as well, as a type of becoming, a type of being. And then the asava of, just that fundamental asava, avijhasava, of just, I was talking about it this afternoon with a group that was here, avijha being normally translated as ignorance, but maybe that's maybe not such a good translation. Maybe there isn't a good translation, because vijha is like true knowledge, avijha is sort of a lack of true knowledge. So that's that. When we overlay all of our experience with a lack of kind of true knowledge, then we get tangled up. And that's where Lupa Samedo has this memorable phrase of avijja, or ignorance, complicates everything. It's very simple. So that where, again, learn this intuitive awareness is the antidote to avijja. This direct knowing has the ability to turn it over. Because in each of these things that the Buddha taught about as a purpose or function, then he also gave the, you know, how it's applied, so that to say the samadhi, the stability of mind that we're cultivating, is applied in a certain way to achieve that goal. And so the Buddha said, this is where the investigation of the aggregates of being, and that we identify with as a person, a me, a being, so the body, we identify with that as this is who I am, the feelings, the vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we identify with that, that's who I am, we have a feeling, we create an identity around that, perceptions in terms of memory, association, the mental formations, which are the whole range of thought, emotion, application of mind in different ways, and then consciousness. So then the Buddha, how we apply that samadhi is to direct attention in a way that recognizes that this is the arising of the experience of body, this is its cessation. This is the arising of feeling, this is its cessation. This is the arising of perception, this is its cessation. This is the so that rather than paying attention to all of the nuance in similar in that sense, and that's where it comes back to stepping back from the reactions that we have, the assessments, the kind of that inner commentator that is personalizing and identifying and creating a sense of self around it, coming back to something more fundamental. This is it's what it is. It's a emotion, it's a thought, it's a memory, it's a feeling, or it's just this body. This is its presence, this is its cessation. And tuning into that, of course, again, that having a tangible doorway into that experience is the function of the breath. And sensation of the breath as it arises, sensation of the breath as it ceases. Returning to the breath, using the breath as a vehicle of experience, a vehicle for laying that foundation of intuitive awareness, a quality of knowing, so that it's not sort of knowing this bit of information about the Buddha's teaching or this viewpoint and doctrinal position, but it's just knowing. Arising, knowing, ceasing. Yeah. And that, it's enough to free the heart. It's enough to liberate us from suffering. And it's not beyond any of our capability. We all have that capacity to know, to experience, so that to give ourselves the encouragement and to tune into that experience of the breath, tune into that experience of the quality of, breathing in, brightening, breathing out, softening, breathing in, that energizing, breathing out, relaxing. Just that much is enough. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.